none of the changes that we're recommending today would have changed the result of the 2010 election.
The Lieutenant Governor completes a review of the 2010 Senate election. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a plan to help municipal budgets.
So what this legislation does is shares with municipalities when the price of oil is high.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
the Association of Alaska School Boards. AASB believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell released the state's review of Alaska's 2010 election to the legislature and the public today. Governor Sean Parnell and Treadwell promised to complete a review of last year's election when they signed the certification documents in December. Treadwell said the State Department of Law, the Division of Elections, and others assisted in the review. Many of the proposed changes were prompted by Alaska's thorny Senate race last November.
So as a result of this study, we suggest 34 changes, and the focus of the changes are really in two areas. First off, we want to confirm in law what the courts recommended at the end of the lawsuit on the Senate race, which is that the method by which we count votes needs to follow and take into account the intent of the voter. And there's been legislation pending on that issue. We support that legislation, and the report recommends that we make those changes in law.
After the results of the Senate race were challenged, the courts recommended that the state clarify its election law regarding write-in ballots. Under the state statute, voter intent can be determined by an election official, and the new law would ensure that law is consistent with court rulings. Treadwell said both a Senate and House bill deal with that language. The lieutenant governor said two federal laws are being taken into account while those changes are being considered. They are the Help America Vote Act and the Military Overseas Voting Empowerment Act.
The second thrust of our changes are intended to make it easier for Alaska's servicemen and women, people serving in the military, to vote. And there are several different sets of recommendations there. One is we are making some recommendations to the redistricting board so that polling places make it more easy to bring polling places back on Alaska military bases.
Other changes would move the deadline for declaring write-in candidacy to 21 days before the election. Another would change the primary date.
We are urging the legislature to change the date of the primary election in Alaska. Move it forward 2 weeks. Move it from the third Tuesday in August to the first Tuesday in August. So that if there's any dispute at the end of a primary and a drawn-out election dispute, we would still be ready to get ballots in the mail 45 days before a general election, which is very important under federal law, required under federal law. And we're not the only state that will be moving its primary.
Many of the changes are aimed at the training of and the work done by poll workers. Treadwell said a University of Alaska study done some years ago on ballot security issues was helpful in the review, and the university will be asked to look at security issues as they are today. Treadwell emphasized that the proposed statute changes would not have made any difference in the outcome of Alaska's Senate race.
After a thorough review of Alaska's state case law and the 2010 Senate election, we also concluded that none of the changes that we're recommending today would have changed the result of the 2010 election.
Treadwell said the Federal Department of Justice has to approve any changes in the state's election statute. Local governments and schools would get extra financial help when they face high fuel prices under a bill that passed the Senate today. The measure ties municipal revenue sharing and the base student allocation to oil prices that are more than anticipated when the budget was written. In presenting the measure to the Senate, Senate Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman said the idea came from local residents who complained they couldn't provide services because of high oil prices.
Our coffers are benefiting by the higher price of oil. So what this legislation does is shares with municipalities when the price of oil is high, but does not share when the prices of oil are low.
Hoffman explained that a $1 increase in the annual average price of oil results in an extra $100 million in state revenue. He said the previous year's average oil price is the base for the amount of the supplement, with schools and communities sharing an extra $5 million for every dollar above that amount. As an example of the impact of the supplement, he said for this current year, local schools would share about $20 million. The measure passed on a 19-1 vote. The full program would go into effect next year, but an equivalent amount of money has not been included. The Senate today passed its version of the state's operating budget for next year. Finance co-chair Lyman Hoffman said the plan spends $5.7 billion in state money, only about $10 million less than the total amount the governor proposed in December. There was no opposition to the budget. The plan will return to the House for a confirming vote. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a medical malpractice suit in St. Mary's.
He's lucky to be alive, quite frankly.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The State House last night passed the governor's controversial oil tax bill that is expected to make large reductions in state revenue. The plan's trade-off is the hope that the tax breaks to the oil industry will increase now stagnant production on the North Slope. Five members of the House majority voted against the measure that passed on a 22-16 vote after several hours of debate. Among those Republicans voting against the bill was Majority Leader Alan Osterman of Kodiak. He said he agreed with the need for lowering oil taxes, but he couldn't support the governor's way of doing it.
I'd love it if we had one, if we eliminated every tax credit except one. And that tax credit would be you get a tax credit if you put oil into the pipeline. But that's not what we're doing. We're increasing tax credits in existing fields where they're already pumping down wells.
Earlier in the day, Democrats had unsuccessfully proposed amendments that would have required specific actions or results from oil companies getting the tax benefits. Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan said the bill is a mistake.
What it does is simple. It takes a lot of money, and I mean a lot of money, from the state treasury and gives it to the oil industry. It does not require the oil industry to do anything in return, and it goes on forever.
Many supporters expressed concerns about the technical aspects of the bill. However, they said the recognition that oil production is declining overshadowed those concerns. Juneau Republican Kathy Munoz said Alaska has been fortunate in the past few years, while the rest of the country has suffered.
But Alaska's future is uncertain. We have to act. There is the option of doing nothing is really not an option. And HB 110 may not be the perfect plan, but it will continue to move through the process and it will continue to be revised. I am very confident today that we're making the right choice.
The bill next goes to the Senate, where the bipartisan majority has said it will not pass. Tomorrow is the kickoff of the Imagination Library in Dillingham. They'll be celebrating a program that gives kids a free book each month from birth through age 5. In rural places like Dillingham that often don't have billboards and road signs, experts say it's critical to find creative ways to get kids to read. KDLG's Daisha Eaton brings us the story of an Alaska Native woman who's partnering with a country western legend to get books inside homes.
Like schools across Alaska, Dillingham High School is trying to figure out how to improve graduation rates. They've added mentorship programs, they're looking at starting college prep classes, and improving teacher retention. But new research suggests you have to start earlier, much earlier.
There's no picture, so you have to use your imagination.
Robin Chaney lives in Dillingham. She has three kids and is a member of the Chogyam tribe. The petite woman with long black hair and small round glasses sits in a brightly decorated corner of the Dillingham Library, surrounded by mothers with babies on their laps and toddlers all bouncing up and down in their miniature bright yellow plastic chairs. Today she's reading about spaghetti.
Spaghetti! Spaghetti! You're wonderful stuff! I love you, spaghetti! I can't get enough!
It doesn't really matter what she's reading about. It just matters that she's reading to them. This is the exact age when experts say reading is critical, pre-kindergarten. When Chaney learned that, she decided she wanted to do something more to get those really little kids that couldn't make it to her weekly story hour for one reason or another, reading. Recently, she got some help from someone she never expected.
Hi, I'm Dolly Parton. You hold the key that can open the door to excitement, adventure, and learning.
And it's never. That's Parton talking about the Imagination Library, part of her Dollywood Foundation's effort to get parents reading to their children. Reading's an issue near to Parton's heart, as she grew up poor in rural Tennessee, with few books. She sings about it in her song, Coat of Many Colors.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth, I recall a box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to you.
The Imagination Library gives kids a book a month from birth through their fifth birthday, absolutely free.
So last summer we found a group of really motivated parents who were willing to be involved and put a little board together and put in a grant. We were awarded our grant this fall.
Best Beginnings, a statewide nonprofit literacy program, coordinates Imagination Libraries in Alaska and provides grants to pay for the books. Chaney says when she started working with Best Beginnings, she knew reading to little kids was important. But the more she learned, the more she realized, even though it doesn't seem like they understand.
It really begins when they're young children. We have kids coming into kindergarten who are behind, which is kind of a new thing for me that I became aware of, that children can come in without some pre-reading skills, and that makes them struggle in their early years in school.
Barbara Brown with Best Beginnings says Chaney's right. Over the first year of life, the brain more than doubles in size. By age three, a child's brain is twice as active as an adult's. Reading with kids during this time helps them make sense of their new world, laying the foundation for future learning. But many kids in Alaska aren't getting what they need before kindergarten, Brown explains.
Right now in the state, there's an assessment done of kindergarten children the first week as they show up for kindergarten. And in that assessment, it's showing real clearly that children are showing up for kindergarten missing basic building blocks for learning.
So if a kid comes to kindergarten and they can't do certain things like sound out words or rhyme, things kids learn through reading, Brown says they usually stay behind all the way to third grade. And that's when reading experts say you're supposed to be able to read.
What they usually say is that you're learning to read up to third grade, but after third grade, you need to know how to read in order to read to learn.
That's when it's all over, not middle school, not high school, third grade. And more studies are saying it's where kids are on that first day of kindergarten that determines it all. Reading, high school, graduation, even college, a job, and general success in life. In rural communities like Dillingham that aren't what experts call literacy rich, that's a particular concern, Chaney explains.
There maybe aren't signs. There maybe, you know, there just aren't a lot of words that you would see in the community, exit signs, stop signs. And so by having these books, the Imagination Library, what we're doing is we're having books in people's homes that hopefully, if parents aren't reading, older siblings can read to them. And if a child is signed up when they're born, by the time they hit the five-year cutoff, they might have a library of 60 books in their home. And so we're hoping if they're there, we're making their home more literacy rich. There are more words, more stories.
In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Sitka Sound Sacro Herring Fishery had its second opening this afternoon, and the second day's harvest was much larger than the first. The fishery opened today at 1:40 p.m. and closed a little more than an hour later. Early estimates put today's catch at around 5,000 tons. The guideline harvest level for this year's fishery is 19,490 tons.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
A mother from the Yukon village of St. Mary's was awarded more than $250,000 in a medical malpractice suit that arose after complications from a boil her son had. From member station KYUK, Shane Iverson reports.
A mother from the Yukon village of St. Mary's was awarded over $250,000 in a medical malpractice suit that arose after complications from a boil. The mother, whose first name is not being released by her attorney, filed suit in 2007 after her 14-month-old son became unresponsive from complications arising from sepsis, also known as MRSA and commonly manifested as a boil on the skin. The suit was filed against the United States government for medical services performed at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation's subregional clinic in the Yukon village of St. Mary's. The mother took her child to the clinic twice to have the boil treated. There, they received only a hot pack and medication.
He had a very serious condition. He developed MRSA because of the abscess, because the abscess was not incised and drained. He then went into septic shock and end organ failure.
That's the plaintiff's attorney, Michelle Power, with the private firm Power & Brown in Bethel.
He's lucky to be alive, quite frankly, and we're gratified that the trial ended in a verdict for this child.
The United States District Court for the District of Alaska entered a verdict of nearly $240,000 in the case. Judge John Sedgwick found that the YKHC Health Aid breached the standard of medical care by not incising the boil and draining it.
Because the physician assistant didn't follow the standard of care, and that this little boy suffered so that it was appropriate to award money to this child and to his mother and to pay back medical costs.
YKHC is the health care provider for 58 tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. As a tribal organization, it administers health care on behalf of the Indian Health Service, which is why it was the United States government that was sued. Judge Sedgwick ordered that the government pay the Afghan family almost $89,000 in economic damages and another $145,000 for non-economic damages. The family was asking for more, hundreds of thousands of dollars more, but Sedgwick ruled that the plaintiffs did not prove that the health aid acted recklessly or was grossly negligent. He wrote in his decision, quote, "The failure to incise and drain was based on a rational, if in the circumstances faulty plan, that in other situations might have been appropriate." The Afghans were also seeking compensation for an undisclosed neurological disorder that they say was caused by the complications from sepsis, but Cedric said in his ruling that that disorder was not caused by the sepsis. The Afghans' attorneys say they have until next week to appeal that decision, but they have not yet decided if they will.
That report from KYUK's Shane Iverson in Bethel. In Fairbanks, Golden Valley Electric Association may pursue trucking in North Slope natural gas as a means to getting a cheaper, cleaner-burning fuel to generate power. The utility is among several major potential gas customers already working with the Alaska Gasline Port Authority on a similar project. But GVEA President and CEO Brian Newton says the electric co-op is comparing the potential benefits of going it alone with those of teaming up with the Port Authority.
Was the AGPA deal better or worse? You know, is the risk better or worse if Golden Valley does it, or go with AGPA? That's what we have to figure out before we move ahead.
The voter-created Port Authority's gas trucking project is estimated to cost $250 million. Newton says GVEA may be able to do a project for less.
My cost of financing is less. Hopefully my gas contract might be less. We're trying to hope to get a lower gas contract. We're a nonprofit operation. AGPA says they are too, but you know, I mean, again, what is, you know, I'm not sure what AGPA really is. I know what Golden Valley is, but I'm not sure what AGPA is. So, you know, is their form structure of business better or worse than ours? That's one of the comparisons we'll make.
Golden Valley representatives are traveling to Southern California to check out a natural gas trucking operation that uses a processing facility similar to one that would have to be built on the North Slope to liquefy gas for transport via tankers down the Dalton Highway. Newton says GVEA needs to see if the technology will work in Alaska. One of the biggest tsunamis of the 20th century was generated by an earthquake off the coast of the Aleutian Islands on April 1, 1946. While a series of waves hit Hawaii, then California, and even South America, causing destruction and deaths, a local tsunami 13 stories high devastated a Coast Guard lighthouse on Unimak Island. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Those who study tsunamis have long known that earthquakes and underwater landslides possibly triggered by the quake deliver a one-two punch when it comes to creating the series of destructive waves. But one event in particular has puzzled researchers. The 1946 tsunami that was spawned in Alaska reached Hilo, Hawaii, with devastating results. Paul Whitmore, director of the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, says it's an odd case.
We're still not sure exactly what the magnitude on that was. Originally, it was assigned a 7.4, but later studies show that it may be up closer to 8.5 or 8.6.
But the wave it triggered and the local tsunami, which demolished the Coast Guard lighthouse on Unimak Island and killed the five men in it, was much larger than it should have been. Scientists have studied the event for decades with no answer. Whitmore says one theory is that there could have been an undersea landslide triggered by the earthquake, but so far there's no proof of that.
It looks like from the aftershocks of the earthquake that the earth only ruptured less than 150 kilometers. And that's very small, short amount for an earthquake of that size. So because of that, it had some unusual properties. If it only ruptured that length, it probably had a very large slip on the fault, and a lot of seafloor was then displaced. There's been other suggestions that maybe there was a landslide that accompanied the earthquake, but there's never been any evidence found.
The local wave hit the five-story lighthouse at night. There were no witnesses, but photos of the lighthouse before the wave and its site after tell the dreadful tale. Whitmore says the wave that hit the lighthouse could have been similar to a huge bore tide.
Sometimes tsunamis in certain cases will form a bore or a wall of water, and we don't really know for sure what the wave was that impacted Scotch Cap Lighthouse. There was no survivors of people who actually witnessed the wave. It's not certain that it was a bore, but given the level of damage, that's certainly possible.
In Hawaii, the tsunami triggered by the Aleutian quake clobbered the Big Island, taking 159 lives and causing huge destruction in the city of Hilo.
It would have had to have been huge to trigger the size of the wave that went down to Hawaii, and that should have left some evidence underneath the sea, and we don't find any. So people think today that it was the earthquake itself that generated that tsunami.
In recent years, the Scripps Institution of Oceanography mapped the seafloor in the area of the earthquake and did not come up with any evidence of a landslide. Other researchers have suggested that the earthquake itself was larger than the 1946 instruments were able to measure. The Pacific Tsunami Museum in Hilo, Hawaii, possesses many photos of both the terrifying onrushing wave and its devastating aftermath. Donna Psyche with the Pacific Tsunami Museum looks back.
One of the first things people noticed was a nice little flood of water coming in. The first wave was the crest approaching the Hilo Bay. And most people didn't have experiences with large tsunamis, and so many of them watched as the water came in. Those who knew, as a friend of mine, for example, said he looked out his window, and when he reported to his father that asked him who brought the fish that was floundering about on the front steps. And when they went out to see who was visiting, of course, no one was there. And they saw the area all around the house was wet and the water was receding. Luckily, they knew what they were observing and they ran. And their house was demolished in the succeeding waves.
Whatever the cause, it was the April 1st, 1946 tsunami that prompted the federal government to institute the National Tsunami Warning System we have today. Even with the current warning system, Whitmore cautions that those who live near the coast need to pay attention to the signs.
The earthquake itself is nature's warning. That's the best warning you can get. That's the earliest warning you'll ever get, is that if you're on the shore and you feel an earthquake shake for 20 seconds or more, that's a clue that the earthquake is big enough and close enough that it can trigger a tsunami.
He says a strong quake close to the coast can send a wave within minutes. And the five men killed at Scotch Cap, they lived long enough to record that it took 48 minutes after the earthquake for the first wave to hit. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Haines has one of the largest annual gatherings of American bald eagles in the world. But because of new research about their local habitat, biologists are now considering moving the entire bird population. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell has the story.
Fish and Game's Natural World Order Department has just completed and made public the findings of a 20-year study of Chilkat Valley American bald eagles. The shocking results reveal that the American bald eagle that is found in such abundance in the Upper Chilkat Valley is possibly an invasive species and not natural to the environment. The surprising data has initiated an about-face in the department's future management plans. The initial hope of reinstating the bounty system failed when the cost of eagle bounty was readjusted to compensate for inflation over the past 80 years. The question remains unanswered on how to deal with this new biohazard. Smithman Vargas of the Natural World Order Department.
Yes, well, possibly we're thinking of physically moving the eagle population to BLM, Bureau of Land Management property, or, you know, possibly launching another study on this study. You know, right now we're scrambling to get a new name, one that, you know, accurately portrays what is the natural, you know, what's natural, something upon, like, you know, along the lines of the Chilkat Valley Torrential Rain Raft Guide Preserve.
In a related story, as plans unfold to repeal the law establishing the Chilkoot Valley Bald Eagle Preserve, anxious mining conglomerates clamor at the prospects of opening mining exploration sites along the Chilkat River, where thousands of bald eagles now reside. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
Oh, you caught that right. April Fools, Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.